Welcome to Health Cetera in the Catskills on WIOX Radio. I'm Diana Mason, the host of this program, where we focus on the impact of local, state, national, and international issues on the health of the individuals, families, and communities in the Central Catskill region. I've been talking a lot on Health Cetera about the shortage of nurses and other healthcare workers. And since 2002, we've had lots of robust research documenting the impact of inadequate staffing on patient complications and even death. But only California has managed to pass a law that mandates minimum nurse staffing levels. And opposition to when other states put forth these bills to have such mandates as California has, their opposition always includes hospital administrators, which you sort of expect, but it has sometimes included members of the nursing community itself. And recently, Dr. Andrea Brassard wrote a blog about some shifts that may be happening as a federal bill to address staffing has been introduced into Congress. Dr. Brassard is a nurse practitioner, associate professor at the University of Maryland Baltimore School of Nursing. She has served as senior policy advisor in the Public Policy Institute at AARP, where she worked on what's called the Future of Nursing Campaign for Action Initiative, that was designed to foster implementation of recommendations from a National Academy of Medicine report on nursing. And we'll talk a little bit about that. She also served as the director of health policy at the American Nurses Association. And for transparency purposes, she also wrote a chapter on the political context of advanced practice nursing for a book that I'm the lead editor on, Policy and Politics in Nursing and Healthcare. Andrea Brassard, thank you so much for coming on early and being on at all today with me.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Diana. I'm thrilled to talk to you. As you said, I'm a professor, and I teach mainly graduate students. So my students are all working nurses, and I just hear from them how tough it is out there.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we know that COVID had an impact, certainly on healthcare worker supply in general, but we weren't in good shape before the COVID, were we?
No, we weren't. In fact, I was trying to rack my brain. I think the last time that we didn't have a nursing shortage was about when I graduated from nursing school. I couldn't get my first choice job, which was 5 miles away at a hospital, so I had to drive 30 miles to an urban hospital. But we're talking nursing shortage for 40 years, but the COVID just shone a light on this issue.
Yeah. So talk a little bit about why COVID was so impactful.
So a couple of things. Hospitals kind of emptied out with COVID, and I should say all of this is my opinion.
Yes.
Canceled surgeries and laid off nurses, and nurses who stayed had to deal with the lack of personal protective equipment, the patients, sick patients,
yeah.
Patients dying, not knowing how to treat them, learning as they went. Any nurse who could retire from a hospital probably did.
Yeah. And there have been a number of studies that are suggesting that the nurses who are still practicing, a high percentage, anywhere ranging from 25% to I've seen as high as 40 or 50%, are planning on leaving within the next year to 5 years. Is that what you're seeing?
Yes. That's what I'm seeing. And we're really scared about this for our loved ones and for ourselves.
Yeah.
And I can tell you that we are educating nurses as fast as we can, but I don't think we can keep up.
Yeah. In fact, in the 90s, when we had another severe shortage, I talked about the revolving door. We've got to stop the revolving door. We keep producing them, and then they go out the door. They leave. And so this is not a short-term issue, and this is what I think is really important for people to understand. This is not going to get fixed in the next 5 years, maybe not the next 10 years. And so why should the public care about this?
The public should care because the reason that you're in a hospital is because you need nursing care. If what you needed was surgery, you could go to a surgical center. But if you needed major surgery, you need nursing care after the surgery. You need nursing care when you're critically ill. You need nursing care when you're having a baby. Children need nursing care when they're acutely ill. It's nurses that is why you go to a hospital.
And we were, I remember in the 1990s, we kept saying patients are going to die because you're not staffing adequately. You're replacing nurses with people who aren't even licensed and expecting them to do nursing jobs. And we kept saying people are going to die. They are dying. What was thrown back at us was, where's the research? Where's the evidence? And we really didn't have strong research until 2002. There was a study by Linda Aiken at the University of Pennsylvania and Jack Needleman, who I think was out at UCLA then, that really documented this, right?
And the term that these researchers used is failure to rescue.
Yes.
So it wasn't like COVID when sadly patients were dying. It was that complications came. But the other part, Diana, and we hear this from our nurse, from my students, is the missed nursing care. Mm. The nursing care is not as thorough as it could be, because the nurses have too many patients to take care of. So they can only do the absolute essentials.
And not even the essentials, I would argue. They're sometimes, you know, spending more time at the computer because of all the documentation they have to do that they'll get penalized for, but not for the missed care. They'll get penalized if they don't document something, right? The other thing that I think came out of the 2002 study with failure to rescue, I think is this idea that if you're a nurse on a regular medical surgical floor, if you have four patients, for every patient you add to that nurse's load, you have a 7% increased likelihood of a patient dying on your shift.
Yes.
And that's pretty frightening. I mean, I also like to describe the failure to rescue this way, that if people think when the nurse comes in the room, and I had a producer once of Katie Couric's television program. I was going on, and she was telling me, I was in the hospital, and the nurse would come in, and she was just chatty. And I told her I didn't want to talk to her. I only wanted to talk to the doctor. And I said, but that was pretty stupid, because while you think she's being chatty, she's actually observing you in all kinds of detail, how you're breathing, whether you're fit, what your color is, whether your IV is working, if you're sweating, if you're clenched fists. And I said, you could be going down the tubes, and if that nurse isn't in the room chatting with you, it might not get picked up. And so I think people don't realize that you can start to deteriorate, and if there's not somebody knowledgeable about the signs of deterioration, you crash.
Well, I don't want to terrify your audience, but
they should be terrified.
we nurses say, don't go to the hospital alone.
That's right. That's right.
You know, if you don't have a nurse in the family, have a family member.
So why are we in this predicament?
Oh, again, these are my opinions.
Yes,
I think there's some greed with the hospital executive salaries. I think I think that we have a shortage of nurse faculty to teach these students, and that's been going on for many years. And when you talked about the Campaign for Action, that was one of the first things that the AARP Center to Champion Nursing in America worked on, was to try to get more nurse faculty. And nursing is just hard. It's a hard job, and until recently did not really pay very well.
I think a major reason these days is because there is not the support that's necessary from administration for the hard work these nurses are doing, that they don't feel the support. They don't feel like they're in a supportive environment, that they're listened to when they say the staffing is not adequate. I've been hearing, and in fact, a study that I talked about on HealthCetera, I had Chris Fries on a few weeks ago, talking about the study he did with Marita Titler and some others out of Michigan, where they found that the greatest predictor of the likelihood of leaving or planning to leave a position, actually leaving or planning to leave, was mandatory overtime being used frequently.
Oh, okay.
And for people who don't realize, this is mandatory overtime is when you're told you have to stay at work. And you may have kids coming at home that you need to meet. Right? You may have something else that you need to do, but you're told if you don't stay, you can lose your job. I mean, is that fair?
No, absolutely. Absolutely not. And there has been attempts, federal laws to stop mandatory overtime, but that didn't go anywhere. This federal bill.
Yes, talk about that. Yeah.
The bill has been introduced since 2004, so we're talking almost 20 years, and it just doesn't seem to advance. But what I see, Diana, and when you talked about nurses not getting recognition, we had this great opportunity during the pandemic where the public saw how important nurses were. But it didn't translate. It didn't become a long-lasting thing, you know. And nurses say, don't give me the box of pizza. Give me the same salary as you're paying the travel nurses. Don't make me stay over. Give me enough help so I can take care of patients properly.
Yeah. So I just want to, we should explain the box of pizza.
Okay.
So people probably have heard that Nurses Week, Nurses Month, May is Nurses Month. We're now up to a month. Nurses Week is usually centered somewhere around May 9th, which was Florence Nightingale's birthday. And the typical thing that hospitals do is to feed nurses. And I've always found that a little disgusting, that you're going to feed us for a week, and we're going to go back to the same situation we're working in. You really think that just feeding us is the answer?
Yeah. Now I don't want to tell your listeners. Don't think the nurses do like.
Yeah, they do.
Like food. but what they really want is to be able to do their jobs. They really want the resources, which means fewer patients to do their jobs.
Yeah. And you mentioned CEO salaries. Say a little bit more about that. I'm not quite sure everybody understands how much some of these CEOs of hospitals are making while they're cutting staff. Yeah.
Right. And I don't have it in front of me, but I read about a CEO who is making $30 million. $30 million. You know, when we look at industry leaders, if you know, making millions of dollars, it just doesn't seem right to me that not-for-profit hospitals CEOs should be making this much money.
Yeah, I agree. Now, Now, we've talked a bit about the federal Nurse Staffing Standards for Hospital Patient Safety and Quality Care Act that's before Congress and has been there for a number of years. But there's more of a likelihood right now, but I'm thinking, and we can talk about that in a moment, but tell people first about what's happened in California.
So what happened in California, and like you said, Diana, in the 90s, when it was really acute, the California Nurses Association, which broke away from the American Nurses Association, is a nursing union, and they put forth this bill to that, for example, in ICU, a nurse wouldn't have more than two patients. In medical surgical floors, four patients, and it got introduced and it passed. Our friend Joanne Spetz said in her chapter in your book that there was a Democratic governor who kind of shepherded this. Mm-hmm. But sadly, it took forever for this bill to get implemented. It passed in 1999. It wasn't going to be implemented until 2004. And then Governor Schwarzenegger stopped it. Mm-hmm. So the California Nurses Association really took some strong action to get this moving again. And I think that's kind of why we don't have the research, because it really hasn't been in effect for 20 years.
Yeah,
it's been shorter. I will say, as I was working on this blog and talking to colleagues, there are some states that have been successful with publicly reporting the nurse to patient ratios, and mm-hmm. my home state, New Jersey, your neighboring state, has had this public reporting for about 10 years. I have unpublished data from a colleague, Sam Dig Cordova at Rutgers, who looked at, in 2015, med-surg nurses were on average had 5.2 patients. In 2022, this increased to 5.8 patients.
Yeah.
In intermediate care units, telemetry, post-ICU units, 2015, 4 patients. 2022, 5.2 patients. And what the most scary to me was ICU, 2015, 2.5 patients. 2022, 4 patients.
Oh, in the ICU?
ICU as intensive care.
Oh my gosh!
And what got me writing this blog was my student who told me about the night that she had three patients and she worked, you know, the 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. and she had to, you know, take care of her most critical patients first. And by the time she got to her what she thought stable patient, at 11 p.m., that patient was no longer stable, and she almost lost him.
Wow. Wow. And she was working in what kind of an area? ICU?
ICU.
Wow.
ICU.
So,
when she came on, she said, three patients is not safe.
No.
But, you know, you're it. There are three patients, and do the best you can.
No. So for listeners, I would have said mostly you should have a 1-to-1 ratio with a patient in an intensive care unit these days. Maybe 1-to-2, depending upon the acuity level of the patient, but 1-to-3 uh-huh. would be unheard of. Now, I know there were more during COVID because, sure, there were, you know, hospitals were overflowing and people were doing the best they could, but you don't want to go into a hospital where they're staffing at a 1-to-3 or 1-to-4 ratio in the ICU. And I've always told people, if you're having surgery done that's pre-planned or you're planning a hospital visit, find out, ask, what floor am I going to be on and what is the nurse-patient ratio? And they should be able to tell you. And if it's a general floor, once you start getting more than five patients on a general floor, I would be very concerned. And I tell people, and as you said at the opening, you need somebody with you these days. You know, you just do.
Yes.
So I know there is some research on the California minimum staffing ratios. And by the way, it is minimum. It doesn't say that you can't, if the minimum ratio is one nurse to four patients on a medical surgical unit, it doesn't mean you can't take that down to one nurse to three patients. It's setting what is the minimum. And yes. I also know that nurse administrators have opposed any mandated staffing. And that's always been curious to me. They say they don't want their hands tied, but I think it's because most of them are members of an organization that is affiliated with the American Hospital Association, and they can't take a position otherwise. What do you think?
Yes. Well, that's what I wrote, and I actually used the word lockstep that the organization was. I thought that might be a little too strong, but I haven't gotten.
Have you? Oh, nobody's.
That.
Yeah. No, nobody's hammering down your door about the blog.
No.
No, good. So another recent change, with which you know all too well, having served as the policy director for the American Nurse Association, is that the American Nurses Association has long been opposed to a mandated staffing, minimum staffing ratios, arguing that nursing needs to be able to set staffing based upon patient acuity, the education of the staff, that kind of thing, what kind of floor it is, that kind of thing, mix of patients, et cetera. And, but that has shifted, right?
Right. And I think, you know, the joint statement that I refer to in my blog is the American Association of Critical Care Nurses, and they are leading the way. And in fact, on their website, they have some good ideas for creative staffing, having their own, growing your own staffing agency, and having some shorter shifts instead of doing nurses doing the 12-hour shifts. Nurses might come back if the shifts were 4 hours. Or 8 hours, and I think the American Association of Critical Care Nurses is what's driving that change.
And they had been opposed to minimum staffing ratios, but have really put a laser beam on the staffing issue because they were hearing it from their members that this is not sustainable. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So what do you think will happen? Do you think there's going to be movement on the federal legislation?
I don't know why. I don't know. I put out a pledge that this is something that ANA should support and have their biggest advocacy campaign ever. And it's not that this will solve the problem, but it's a step.
Yeah.
And, Diana, we have to do something for the nurses and for the patients.
Yeah. So that is the Nurse Staffing Standards for Hospital Patient Safety and Quality Care Act. And if you're concerned about that, that's before Congress, the House of Representatives and the Senate. And feel free to talk to your representatives about whether you care about that or not. So I also, you worked for a number of years with what's called the Campaign for Future of Nursing Campaign for Action. And this came about with the first report on the future of nursing that came out in 2010, 2011. And you were went to AARP, their Center for Championing Nursing in America. They were funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation to look at how to implement the recommendations in that report, because National Academy of Medicine reports make recommendations, but they don't do follow-up. They don't act on those recommendations per se. So we've now had another report, a second report that came out, what year was that? 2021, 2020? Came out COVID, and it got delayed because of COVID.
Exactly.
So tell us about that campaign and why it has mattered. I mean, here we are in this terrible shape. We've had two future of nursing reports. We've had all this money invested in implementing the recommendations, and we're still not in good shape.
But you know, for RNs, for staff nurses, for hospital nurses, no, we're not in good shape. We are seeing some progress with federal leak for nurse-patient ratio, nurses in nursing homes, skilled nursing facilities. We're seeing some movement there. And I work, as you said, I'm a nurse practitioner, and when we started the campaign, we had 14 states where nurse practitioners could practice to the full extent of their education and training, and now we're up to 27.
Which is great.
So that that changed by shedding a light that this is important to consumers. This is important to patients and their family caregivers. The nurse practitioners are out there. They do most of the house calls. Mm-hmm. You know, some of them have independent house call practices. They're in school, in school clinics. We do a great job at looking at patients holistically.
I've been concerned because what people may not be aware of is that there is a movement to have nurse practitioners have clinical doctorates, and these programs have proliferated across the country. So your Dr. Andrea Prasad, I don't know if your doctorate is a PhD or a
DNP. It is
DNP.
A PhD. No, it's a PhD. Yeah, okay. I graduated from Columbia University.
Great. So for somebody with a clinical doctorate, they have a DNP, a Doctorate of Nursing Practice. There are now states where the medical societies, a few states where the medical societies have passed laws saying that only physicians, dentists, osteopaths, and veterinarians can use the doctor title.
Yeah.
That's a little...
That's really unfortunate because... you know, doctors of philosophy have used the title psychologist, have used the title for years.
Yeah, and so if you think about those four professions, medicine, osteopaths, veterinarians, and dentists, traditionally all male.
Yes.
So they were the ones to be called doctor. Nobody else was to be called doctor. It's a little bit concerning. It certainly is a big turf issue that's sort of ridiculous, isn't it?
Well, that's why at ARP, at the Campaign for Action, we're trying to change it from a turf issue and make it a access to care issue.
Yeah.
Patient access to care.
Yeah, yeah. So what else? What else would you report on from the Campaign for Action that made a difference, you think?
So I think the diversity, even though it's the needle is moving very slowly on having nurses who represent their proportion of their racial ethnic background in the population, we've seen change. The American Nurses Association came out with a report on and an apology for the many years that the American Nurses Association excluded African American nurses from their membership. So I was pleased to see that.
People might be interested that in the early years of the association, when it had another name, you could not be a member if you were a person of color. And so there was an association just for what was called graduates of colored nursing schools. Mm-hmm. And then the ANA, I don't know if this was, I think it was the 60s, maybe late 50s, said, well, you don't need another organization. You can come and join us. But they couldn't join in some states. And so while they did give up their organization, they later found that they didn't have a voice. And so they formed the Black Nurses Association, which exists to this day. And many are members of both.
Yes, yes.
You know, the other... Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. No, go ahead.
The other thing that I think really came out of the first Future of Nursing report is this recommendation that nurses be at all decision-making tables. And there has been this huge push to get nurses appointed to boards, to commissions, to task forces, et cetera. And so if there's a hospital board that doesn't have a nurse on it, shame on that hospital. If there is a nonprofit organization that is at all concerned about health and social well-being, you should have a nurse on it. Why does it matter, Andrea?
It matters because of the perspective that we bring. How we view the whole person, how we view the system. Nurses are working in very complicated systems. So if they're on a board of a national organization, they can look, they can use their systems view to take a critical look at what's happening with the organization. The other thing I want to put a shout out is to Healing Politics, Lisa Summers. Good. And Kimberly Gordon's organization, who just had their first in-person campaign school to get nurses and midwives elected to local, state, and federal offices.
So we're looking to make a major push in getting nurses to elected to state, local, and federal positions. We have a wonderful Congresswoman, Lauren Underwood from Illinois. We have Cori Bush from Missouri, and we have another one. I don't remember who it is.
Oh, it's the she's from California. She was a nurse who became a PA, so she kind of dropped being a nurse.
Oh, okay.
But she does support legislation.
Great. So Andrea Brassard, a nurse practitioner, an associate professor of nursing at the University of Maryland Baltimore School of Nursing, thank you so much for coming on to Health Cetera and giving us a few extra minutes, Andrea. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for this opportunity, and I wish you all the best and your listeners.
Yes.
I hope they can stay out of the hospital.
Me too.
Yes. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye. Thank you. Yeah. Stay out of that hospital. You don't want to be in them if you don't have to. And if you do have to be in them, have somebody with you. It doesn't hurt. I'm Diana Mason. This has been Health Cetera in the Catskills. Have a great week.